Blog Talk Radio.
It's time to strap our boots on. This is a perfect day to die. Wipe the blood out of our eyes. In this life there's no surrender. There's nothing left for us to do. Find the strength to see this through. We are the ones who will never be broken. With our final breath, we'll fight to the death. We are soldiers, we are soldiers.
Coming in to a special edition of Bard's Logic Political Talk, part of the growing conservative conversation. For the regulars who come in here, they know that normally on Friday nights I do rebroadcast of my shows, but tonight we have a very special guest, which is the presidential candidate for the America's Party, Tom Hoefling, and which we will be bringing him on shortly as I wait for some others to come in. So they don't miss, or they miss as little of the interview as possible. And if you are new to the show and you like what you hear tonight, I'd really appreciate if you followed it. And it would be easy way to do that is just go to the homepage of Bard's Logic Political Talk. And under the show's icon, you will see a little follow button. Just click on that, and it'll take you to how you can follow the show. And also, you will see on the front page of, or the homepage, I should say, of Bard's Logic Political Talk, are two links in the description area. And one of those, of course, is Tom Hoefling's website itself at www.tomhoefling.com, and also the website, what I believe is the America's Party's website, which is www.selfgovernment.us. And those two links will take you to those websites. Now, normally I would just go down and do a description of what, or give a bio of what the show is or the person I'm interviewing tonight, but the bio for Mr. Hoefling is very extensive, so I leave that to the audience to read all of his credentials, and then it'll take less time away from the show and thus from the interview. And that being said, I would like to take this time now to open up the mic and let in Tom Hoefling, and we will have a one-on-one for about an hour interview, and then he was gracious enough to agree to take questions from people from the audience, both call-in and in the chat. So without further ado, thank you very much, Tom, for coming in. And how are you doing this evening?
Hey, I'm happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, great. It's real great to have you here. Now, the little format I like to do tonight is, you know, I've got a series of questions, and I like to spend about 3 minutes on each of them, and then later on in the interview, or in the question section, we can elaborate on some points that bear more information. How's that sound to you?
Sounds fine.
Great, because I got a series of questions. We'll go right into it, and looking at your bio and seeing that, the first question I'd like for you to it's more of a statement than a question, but if you could tell us of your experience in the Republican Party and in the political field.
Well, I spent about 20 years in the Republican Party as an activist, as someone who worked on campaigns. I started out at the precinct level in my home state of Iowa. I very quickly worked my way up. I was a member of the Republican State Committee in my state. I started working on campaigns. I worked on campaigns at every level and all in most parts of this country over the course of about 20 years.
And to my understanding, you left the Republican Party, correct?
Yeah, I did.
Wearing the America's Party. And why did you move away from the Republican Party?
Well, it took a while. There were a certain series of events that happened that, you know, had me heading for the exits. But the election 4 years ago is what finally drove me out of the GOP. It started when we ran Alan Keyes 4 years ago, or we tried to, but he was pretty much blackballed by the party here in my state. And in fact, on caucus night in 2008, they did not count our votes in Iowa. Now, that's pretty sober.
That's terrible. Yeah.
But when it became apparent that they were going to nominate John Judas McCain, that was it. This is a man who fought against everything I stand for in the back rooms, the cloak rooms of the Senate for a very long time. And, his entire political operations have been and are geared towards electing the most liberal folks in the Republican Party, pro-abortion, pro-homosexual people. So that was the end of the line for me. There was no way. If that's where the Republican Party has gone. Now, we were a little ahead of the curve because we've been telling people for 4 years that it's a dead elephant. it's taken a little longer for a lot of other people to realize that. This election cycle has proved it beyond any shadow of any reasonable doubt. This presidential election cycle has been completely rigged, completely owned by the money interests, completely controlled by the media, and it culminated in Tampa in a convention that was in no sense an American political convention. It was a scripted Soviet propaganda show. That's all it was.
Yeah, and especially, you know, of course, the part with the delegates. And you could even see when they were talking about the rules that on the teleprompter for Boehner, I mean, even when he was saying taking the yays and the nays, you can see that it was already scripted and it was already coming up on the teleprompter to say that the yays won it.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just put it, I'm very blunt, and I'm in a particularly blunt mood these days. But I'll just tell my fellow Christians out there, my fellow conservatives out there, my fellow constitutionalists out there, I'm sorry to tell you this, but every ounce of energy, every bit of time, every bit of money that you put into the Republican nominating process this year was wasted. You know, you can tell a tree by its fruit, and the fruit of that whole process is Mitt Romney, the most liberal governor in the history of the United States.
That's true, and I tell you what, I know a lot of folks who pretty much dedicated their lives for months and months on end. I know, you know, some as early as the late summer and fall of last year working on this particular candidate or the others, only to fight, you know, feel that they're fighting an uphill battle because, as you well know, and it's come to fruition, speaking of fruit, in that the narrative that the Republican Party created in saying that Mitt Romney was going to be the nominee, or, you know, was the heir apparent, so to speak, you know, because a lot of people, I use that term, because a lot of people consider this more like a coronation than a nomination.
Oh. Yeah. Well, and there's another aspect of this, of course, you know, the whole caucus convention process is devoted to selecting a presidential nominee, even though it's completely phony now. The process also is supposed to produce a platform, okay? The platform the Republican Party produced this year is immoral and it's unconstitutional. It has aspects in it that are completely contradictory. The document is self-contradictory. But even if it was a perfect document, it doesn't matter. The party's nominee came out 5 seconds later and said, oh, I don't adhere to that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, if you want to, actually, that was going to be one of the questions: is what your thoughts were on the Republican platform and the Republicans' adherence to it. So let's go ahead and touch on that.
Well, I want to specifically. I haven't read the whole document. I saw enough for me to know the score. I was very active in the platform process for a very long time. And one of the things I was always most proud of the Republican platform was what I call the Reagan pro-life plank. Now, that conservatives got that plank in the platform in 1984, in the midst of the Reagan administration. It was the Reagan plank. And what that plank basically said was the child in the womb is a person, and they are therefore protected by the clear provisions of the 14th Amendment. That was always, to me, the heart of the Republican platform all of these years. Now, it was always a little internally contradictory in that it then called for a constitutional amendment. And I've often asked if the 14th Amendment, and in my opinion, the Fifth Amendment, protect every person and the child and the woman is a person, why do you have to amend the Constitution? But now, in this platform this year, they added a long laundry list of legislation that I consider to be immoral and unconstitutional, bits of legislation that, in effect, end with, and then you can kill the baby. And the crowning shame is their support for fetal pain legislation, which is particularly blatantly, heinously immoral and unconstitutional, in that it creates a subclass of people, little people who can't feel pain. They're not protected. So they created, even put a phrase in there that I consider to be quite Nazi-esque, actually. The phrase is pain-capable unborn children.
Jeez.
So implicit in that is this other class of non-pain-capable unborn children, which is all children up to about 20 weeks of gestation. So it's the perfect Romney kind of document. Ted Kennedy back in the early 90s when Romney ran against Kennedy and tried to outflank him on the left, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Kennedy famously called Mitt Romney a cover-the-road politician, not a middle-of-the-road politician, but a cover-the-road politician. That's how this new Republican platform reads. They just throw everything that they think will sound good to people up there, with no regard for whether any of it actually is consistent and actually forms a coherent political philosophy that one could govern by. And that's the case with their whole pro-life plank. They just throw everything up there that sounds, there's some good words there,
mm-hmm.
but they're contradicted by the rest of the words. And on top of that, the fact is that there's not only no way, no mechanism for the Republican Party to enforce this platform, there's no will to do so. The leaders of the Republican Party pay it no mind whatsoever. Politician after politician in the GOP in recent years has taken the Stephen A. Douglas Democrat, the Gerald R. Ford position on life, which completely contradicts the Reagan plank anyway.
Well, and speaking of that, I'll just go down, and it's a good segue, I think, to the next question, is now how important do you believe the right to life issue is to actually, not just as a political matter, but to the actual future of America?
It's everything. It's the most important thing. Go read the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. It goes on and says, this is the purpose of government, is to protect life, liberty, and property. Okay, and life is the supreme right. You can't enjoy any other right or liberty if you're not alive. So, no, the supreme moral question of our day centers around abortion. As long as we keep killing our posterity. If you go read the preamble to the U.S. Constitution, by the way, the Constitution doesn't call it a preamble. It's, in fact, it is the statement of purpose. Abortion violates every single clause. Especially the crowning clause, which is, what's the purpose of the Constitution? According to the founders, is to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. It's the canceling out, it's the rubbing out, is the annihilation of posterity. So I made a decision a few years back. I wasn't playing games on that issue anymore. And myself and those that I associate with, we give no political aid and comfort any longer to politicians who violate their oath of office in the most fundamental, most important way, which is their refusal to equally protect all innocent human life in this country, every person. That's the main reason that office exists, is to do that.
Okay, what is your plan to address the abortion issue? And what would a Hoefling administration do with that issue, as well as homosexual marriage and states' sovereignty issues that both the Democrats and the Republicans have failed to do?
Well, let me start on the back end of that question and work back, okay?
Sure.
Because when it comes to the protection of life, first of all, God is sovereign, okay? God is the sovereign, the one who made us. And all of our founders believe that completely. It was the ground that all of their foundations were laid on. The battle cry of the American Revolution, I know some people aren't going to like to hear this, but the battle cry of the American Revolution was no king but Jesus. Okay? The state motto of the state of South Dakota is, under God the people rule. Which I think is one of the pithiest, best summings up of what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in this country, we don't have a king except God, right? But we're mm-hmm. the sovereign. Okay, collectively, we as a people, we are the sovereign. These people we elect are simply our ministers. Now, the right to life, the right to liberty, the right to private property, those are individual rights, which the sovereign cannot violate without violating the sovereignty of God. The natural law it forms the premises of this republic.
I would Sorry for interrupting, but how would, when you're in administration, we're talking about a presidential, administration, in what way would it handle, what would be the plan to address and handle issues of state sovereignty? And abortion could be included in that, how would the administration handle those issues?
Well, you're jumping ahead. You really have to allow me, if you will, to form the premises for my actions.
Sure, go
I'm
ahead.
I'm going to give you as straight as I possibly can. The right to life precedes and supersedes any legitimate powers that either the federal government or the state governments have. You see, this is why the Ninth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution says that just because a right isn't listed in here doesn't mean the people don't retain it. That's one thing. Let me give you just as an example a couple of rights that aren't listed that nonetheless are God-given unalienable rights. One would be the right of free political association. That's not spelled out in the Constitution. Do you think that's a God-given right for us to politically associate with whomever we please? How about parental rights? They're not spelled out. Okay. The 10th Amendment, which is critical to understanding this, and it's so misunderstood, and actually there are people out there who are grossly misrepresenting it constantly. Let me just read it. I have it up here on my screen. It says, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Now, see, the states, they don't have any right to alienate the right to life. That right is unalienable. The federal government doesn't have a right. In fact, they have a positive duty and obligation to protect it. According to our nation's charter, the Declaration of Independence, you go read the summations of the work of the committees of correspondence and Samuel Adams. They summed it up exactly the same way. The rights of the colonists are life, liberty, and property, and the duty to defend it. In the Declaration, one of the charges against King George, it says he has abdicated government here by refusing to protect the people and by waging war on them. Said he's abdicated because he wouldn't protect their rights and because he was directly making war on them. So I'm here to tell you, the people who are running around saying that states can alienate the right to life if they want to, and they're calling that state sovereignty or something, they have no understanding of the moral bases for this country. That's a Stephen A. Douglas position. He was pro-choice for states on slavery. In the modern sense, when it comes to abortion, it was Gerald R. Ford and his political hacks who came up with that formulation. Throughout the Reagan years, it was fully understood by conservatives that Gerald R. Ford was not pro-life. He said states can alienate the right to life if they want to. Okay, that's not conservative. That's not according to the Declaration of Independence. It's a violation of all of the stated principles of our U.S. Constitution or its purposes. And on top of all of that, it's a violation of the explicit imperative requirements of the U.S. Constitution in the 5th and the 14th Amendment. Here, let me just quickly read you the words of the 5th Amendment. No person shall be deprived of life without due process of law. Now, don't let the lawyers confuse you. Due process of law is a fair trial on a capital offense. Okay? That's what due process is. And unless you're charged with a capital offense, tried and found guilty by a jury of your peers. None of these little babies, these 55 million little babies, have been tried for a capital offense. They couldn't possibly commit a capital offense. 14th Amendment says, let me just read this because this is important. No state shall deprive any person of life without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. So I stand for the equal protection of the laws for all persons, from the moment they're created until natural death.
We'll definitely, in the second half of the show, I definitely like to elaborate that, especially on how, if you are indeed you know, get the presidency, how an how your administration would go about addressing the abortion issue.
I haven't been shy about it.
I've said
repeatedly and publicly, my first act after taking the oath of office, which is required, so help me God, would be to sit down in the Oval Office, and the first thing would be a presidential finding to the effect that the child in the womb is a person.
Oh, okay. So that's what I'm looking for.
I'm laying the premise. Let me read you a short excerpt from Roe v. Wade, okay? This is Justice Harry Blackmun writing for the majority in Roe v. Wade. He said, the appellate and certain amici argue that the fetus is a person within the language and meaning of the 14th Amendment. In support of this, they outline at length and in detail the well-known facts of fetal development. If this suggestion of personhood is established, the appellant's case, of course, collapses. For the fetus's right to life would then be guaranteed specifically by the amendment. So even Harry Blackmun admitted, if the fetus or child is a person, of course, they're protected by the 14th Amendment. Now we have politicians, Republican politicians, running all over the place now, admitting that the child in the womb is a person. Okay? But then they support policies which act as if the 14th Amendment does not exist. So, to be direct, I would establish this finding, the finding of the executive branch of the United States government. And remember, I'm sworn before God to support the Constitution of the United States. The Constitution of the United States forbids the killing of innocent persons. So I would immediately issue orders to everyone under my authority in the executive branch. In the first place, if you can't agree that the child in the womb is a person, which is self-evident, by the way, that it is. Everybody knows that it is. Everybody knows the child is a person. Of course it is.
Yeah,
everyone knows it. It's self-evident. So, if you can't go along with that, I want your resignation today. And then I would begin to use the power of the U.S. government to shut down the abortion clinics. Now, I would hope that this would be done at the state level and that the governors would do their duty. They are required by the explicit imperative provisions of the Constitution of the United States to stop this wanton killing. And I would hope that they would do that. If they won't, I'll do it.
I've made it pretty clear to my my audience knows where I stand. They know I'm pretty clear that I'm anti-abortion. But I'm going to move on. If we can elaborate this more later on, that's fine. But I do have a whole slew of questions.
Robert, you understand why such an important issue needed and deserved a little bit of extra time.
Definitely. I understand. No, I understand completely. And, as I said, I'm sure it's going to come up in the hour section, the next hour, where we're going to be opening up the calls. Some people who this is their, or not some, but there are many people where the abortion issue is their number one issue. Now, there is, some speculation out there whether it's something that we ought to concentrate on now, because there's other issues that may actually keep us from being able to address the abortion issue at all. But going to the next question is, and of course, in my research, for tonight's interview, I've listened to other interviews you've done and done some reading. And so that being said, I've heard in one of your interviews you talk about federalism. So if you can explain your view on federalism, explain to us your view of federalism. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say because it seems like there is maybe a misconception today what federalism really is, or at least to the point where federalism today is different than what federalism was back towards the founding of the country.
Right. Well, first of all, there's a lot of misunderstanding out there. Our Constitution and its enactment by we the people created dual sovereignties, okay? The states retained a large measure of sovereignty, but they didn't retain it all. You can read through you know, the powers that are spelled out to the general government, many of which contain some of the most important aspects of sovereignty. Okay? So we have a dual sovereign system in terms of the federal and our state governments. Now, the federal government is supposed to be staying within its enumerated powers, and I doubt very many of your listeners would argue with me when I say they are far outside the bounds of the enumerated powers. So many of the state's powers, legitimate powers, have been trampled on. And, of course, the powers of the people. Remember, all of this power flows from the people in the first place. You know, you get a lot of people saying, oh, well, we could do Romney Care, you know, at the state level, and that would all be peachy keen. Well, not unless the people have given the state that kind of power via their state constitutions. Now, I'm not too hot on that either, because I don't like statism, period. I don't want state.
One of the things we talk about a lot on Bard's Logic is that we talk about the U.S. government becoming markedly oligarchical. And one of the questions I like to ask is, that being said, and if one, do you agree that the U.S. government is becoming that way? And two, if so, how would you combat against it?
Well, one of the most important ways we're living under an oligarchy is in terms of the judiciary. And this is a deep problem, one of the most behind almost every battle I've fought for the last 20 years somewhere is an out-of-control judge. They're far outside their powers. They're legislating, they're usurping the powers of the executive, et cetera, and they're violating the Constitution in explicit ways constantly. Now, they couldn't do this if our legislative branch and our executive positions were not full of a bunch of judicial supremacists. These are people like Mitt Romney. Did you notice that? On his pro-life page, Mitt Romney, the first thing he does after the bald-faced lie right up front, which is Mitt Romney is pro-life, the first thing he does is spell out the fact that he's a judicial supremacist and whatever the courts say goes. So in other words, his default position is the status quo, abortion on demand. Did you notice when this horrible Roberts court decision came down on Obamacare, the first thing Mitt Romney said is, well, if Roberts says it's a tax, it's a tax. Okay, he's a judicial supremacist. So we're living under a judicial oligarchy. Because the legislative branch will not contain them and rein them in.
Well, but there is one. We have a gentleman come on here, you know, on a frequent basis, Kelly Mordecai, and he's, an expert for Bard's Logic, pretty much, on the federal grand jury. We talk a lot about the powers of the federal grand jury. Can you tell me what you're familiar with that and how you think they ought to be used, especially with dealing with all the criminality we've been seeing lately with the power grabs and such?
I can't say I'm an expert on the grand jury process. Should grand juries be doing more to rein in what's going on? Of course. But primarily, the control point, okay, the real control point is the legislative branch. You know, we talk about the fact that we have co-equal branches of government, and in some sense that's true. But in another sense, the founders intended the judiciary to be the weakest branch. And in fact, they intended the Congress, being filled supposedly with the representatives of the people, would have the whip hand. That's why they have the veto power over the president, or they have, the impeachment power over both the other branches of government. The fact is, though, they won't use it. Let me give you an example of this whole thing and where we're at from real close to home for me. You may recall a few years back, our state Supreme Court inflicted a legislative from the bench and usurped the role of the executive as well, and inflicted so-called gay marriage on my state of Iowa. Okay, 7 Supreme Court judges, most of them picked by Republicans, by the way, So they did this unconstitutional, unlawful act and imposed this immoral regime on the people of my state. Now, in the next retention election, unfortunately, we have retention elections for judges. The people of Iowa threw the three that were up for a retention election out on their ear. Okay. Subsequently, one of our party affiliates, who serves as a Republican in the state legislature, introduced impeachment resolutions against the other four. The people of my state had already declared what their will was in this matter. And frankly, those impeachment resolutions were buried in committee by the Republican leadership. So they refused to rein these people in. And we still have so-called legal gay marriage, even though our legislative branch has never legalized such a thing. Not that it, even if they did, it would be lawful. But one of the first principles of Western civilization is, it was, you know, pronounced hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago by Augustine. He said, an unjust law is no law at all. But in this case, there isn't any law. We're just living under a judicial dictatorship.
Okay, at this time, I'm going to move in to more into plans and policies at this point in the interview. And what is your plan to increase the amount of jobs? Because it's a big issue, as you well know. So what is your plan to increase the amount of jobs in America?
Reestablish liberty. Quit being a socialist country. Removing more and more and more and more into the socialist camp. So if you want to increase jobs, look, government is not supposed to create jobs. Do you think Romney's going to tell you that? Do you think Obama's going to tell you that? Do you think the Republicans or the Democrats in our legislatures are going to tell you that? It's not the president's job to create jobs. The only jobs he can create are government jobs, which can only be paid for by money extracted from somebody else at the point of the gun. No, you get the government back within its enumerated powers. You take the chokehold off of this economy and the people, and there will be more jobs than you can shake a stick at.
Okay, and well, that's what we'll move on to the next one then, and that is about your tax plan.
Well, I've spent 20 years as a fundamental tax reformer. Way back before there was ever a fair tax, I was heavily involved in the National Retail Sales Tax Alliance, CATS, and other groups, promoting the idea that we needed to get rid of this onerous federal income tax. And I still believe that if you want to recover economically, if you ever want to be prosperous again, in fact, if you want to be free, we've got to repeal the 16th Amendment. We've got to get rid of the income tax. Now, what do you replace it with? You know, go read Federalist 21 and Alexander Hamilton. He spelled it out. You do it with taxes on, you know, with excise taxes. In other words, consumption taxes.
Okay.
So that's what I've been promoting for years and years and years. Now, the fair tax, I've often said I would support it if I was sitting in Congress, if it came before me for a vote. I don't particularly like certain aspects of the fair tax proposal. I don't like the prebate. I don't like the government being in everybody's business. I want the government out of our business. That's one of the beauties of a retail sales tax. You know, the tax is paid only at the point of sale, retail sale. And the people, once again, you know, they're not having their Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights trampled into the dust by an immoral, stupid tax system.
Now, and there's a lot of points on that I agree with, with sales tax instead of income tax. And speaking of a tax, which, you know, we see this come out of our paychecks on a weekly, biweekly, or whenever that happens, is Social Security. So what would you do about the problems with Social Security, Medicare and Medicaid, and how would your administration fix them?
Well, Social Security and Medicare cannot go on forever. At some point, this whole system is going to collapse. It's a Ponzi scheme. That's one point I want to make right up front. So we can either wait for that day and the maximum destruction that will be wrought, or we can resolve it now. Now, on the other end is, look, Social Security was the centerpiece of the New Deal. Medicare was the centerpiece of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. They were not and are not constitutional. They're socialism. They violate everything that James Madison, the father of our Constitution, said. Madison said, I cannot lay my finger on that article of the Constitution that gives the Congress the right to take the money of their constituents for the purposes of benevolence. I just had a debate recently in the run-up to the American Independent Party nomination in California. I had a debate with a number of presidential candidates, one of whom was Virgil Goode of the Constitution Party. He, in the course of the debate, admitted, finally, that these entitlement programs were not constitutional, but he vociferously defended them. He has a budget balancing plan that totally leaves all of that alone and goes directly after the defense budget. Okay, in the first place, that's wrong. In the second place, it won't work. You can't balance a budget on the back of the Defense Department. Thank you very much. But, no, I think these things are unconstitutional. I think we ought to draw back from socialism. I think we ought to repeal and overturn the New Deal. And I think anyone who thinks that we can recover as a country economically and governmentally without overturning the New Deal and going back to being a free people is just fooling themselves.
Okay, and next we move on to foreign policy. And what are your thoughts, or tell us your policies would be, concerning nation building, our presence in the Middle East, and our pledges to help Israel and Taiwan?
Well, let me start with the last one. We have treaties with Israel and Taiwan. We have treaties with many other countries. The founders of this country had very high regard for the obligations of this country, whether you're talking about our debts or whether you're talking about our treaties. Our Constitution puts treaties on a very high level. So we have friends in the world, and we have obligations to them. We have moral obligations in the world, in addition to our treaty obligations. In terms of nation building, well, we shouldn't be building other nations. We should be building ours. But, you know, there's a time for war and there's a time for peace. But war is war, and nation building is something entirely different. I hold to a peace through strength foreign policy, national defense position.
So that include our president?
In my opinion, there's two ditches on every road, okay? And in my opinion, in the foreign policy context today, over here you have the globalists, the transnationalists, which makes up a large part of our political elite, okay? They're in one ditch. They could care less about our national sovereignty. They don't care about our Constitution. They could care less about the people of the United States. They're in one ditch. On the other side, I believe you have the strict isolationists who, I always put it this way. Look, if you live in a house and you hear there's a mob on the other side of town looting and burning and raping and killing, okay, you can close your doors. You can board up your windows. You can do that, okay? But in the first place, that's wrong because we do have obligations to our fellow men, okay? But secondly, it's just in the long run, on a practical level, it's stupid because that mob's going to come be at your door and they're going to knock it down and they're going to kill you and rape your wife and kill your children. So we have people in this world who hate us, Robert. And we're at war whether
we
admit it or not. we're at war whether we admit it or not. A state of war exists. You can stick your head in the sand and pretend that we're not.
I'm just going to move on to the next one, a little switch of gears here. Is what departments would you eliminate or reduce, and why, and how would you go about doing it?
Well, I would eliminate every agency and program that is not among the enumerated powers.
Okay. Any examples for us? Any departments that you give us any examples?
Well, in excess of half of them. I mean, the U.S. Department of Education. The idea that our ministers, the ministers of the sovereign, have the right to control the thoughts, to form the characters or whatever. I mean, I always put it this way. Separate school and state before it's too late. The federal government has absolutely no legitimate right to be meddling in public education, except with the exception of, you know, federal employees and folks in the military. You know, they have to have schools for the children of military people and things like that. But the U.S. Department of Education is completely unconstitutional. If you look at, they certainly have no business in healthcare.
How about the Department of Homeland Security?
Well, I don't even like the word homeland, okay? It sounds, I don't know, to me, it doesn't even sound American to me. I don't know why. It has a European.
So that would be good. Now, well, this might be a question I'll ask later about the EPA, because I'm actually considering myself a conservative environmentalist, and yes, they do exist. but we'll move on because we've got this.
Well,
that's definitely something I'd like to talk to you at some point.
These questions are debatable. Okay, when it comes to the protection of life, okay, that's black and white, and it should be non-negotiable for every American. It should be beyond debate. Okay, when you begin to talk about liberty, okay. You know the old saying, your right to swing your fist ends at my nose, right? So government has a role in playing, you know, a role in making sure that you're not violating my rights and I'm not violating yours, okay? Property, same thing. A big chunk of government is, you know, the governing of contracts and things like that. Some of these things are debatable, and I think we should be having that debate, and that's one of the things I've been trying to facilitate with my campaign.
Mm-hmm.
I think the American people are the ones who should determine constitutionality. We should get in, take our entire federal government apart piece by piece and examine it, and if the people say, that's not in the Constitution, throw it out.
Yeah, well, and I'm sure we'll be talking about the Fed later on this evening, and I'm sure there'll be some questions about the NDAA as well. But for the next question, is what would be your first executive order if you were elected, or orders if you were elected?
Well, there would be two main presidential findings, and these findings are to establish the position of the executive branch during my term, right?
Mm-hmm.
One would be that the child in the womb is a person and therefore protected by the explicit imperative provisions of our Constitution. Another finding would be that our southern border in its current state, and believe me, I've been down there a lot, and it's a war zone. It's virtually open. There would be a finding that open border represents a clear and present danger to the security of the United States. So then, of course, many of the follow-up, first of all, those who rail against executive orders. Now, I understand their sentiment, and I understand how they're right about certain executive orders. You know, where you have an executive legislating by those means, that's wrong. However, the executive has to issue orders. Otherwise, he couldn't execute the laws, okay? He has to issue orders to those who are under his authority. So there's nothing wrong intrinsically with executive orders. I mean, I would order those under my authority to close down the abortion clinics because they're mass slaughter centers. Okay? I would use the force at my disposal as the commander-in-chief to secure that border. We don't lack the ability to secure that border. We've only lacked the will to do so. You could secure that border almost completely just with manpower.
Yeah, and I definitely agree that's very important for the, you know, securing the border. But I see we've got just a little bit. I've got some more questions here. And you mentioned debates earlier. If offered, would you be a part of a national debate with Romney and Obama? Why or why not? If you would or would not.
Sure I would if somebody made that possible. They won't, though.
Yeah, I doubt it. They probably wouldn't want any other voices other than their own.
Well,
but maybe with an
outcry
enough of enough people, maybe that would be something that could be done.
I will debate. I wouldn't be doing this, Robert, if I didn't feel prepared for this. I'm not only willing to debate anyone anywhere that it makes sense, you know, I'm willing to talk to anybody in the country that I can. I'm not giving my time to Wolf Blitzer or whoever's doing their interviews these days. I don't know. I don't follow those people. I'm blackballing them these days. Okay. But if they came, you know, and wanted to talk to me, I'd talk to them just like I would give the same consideration to Joe Sixpack in Kokomo. You know?
Okay. Well, I remember when Romney turned down two interviews that I can recall, one from Texas and then one also from, who's that billionaire guy who ended up endorsing Romney. But anyway, I digress. Okay, we'll move on. So, yeah, I mean, I think it would be very interesting to see someone else in the fray during a debate with Obama and Romney, because I think an Obama-Romney debate is going to be pretty boring, because, I mean, really, I mean, when they look at each other's records, what the heck are they going to debate about?
Well,
so
Robert,
it'd be nice to have someone such as yourself in there, you know, to actually get some of the, you know, the issues covered.
Yeah. I mean, these guys, their intent, and the media's conniving with them, of course, is to make this what I call a Seinfeld election. It's a show about nothing.
Indeed. Well, closing up, I just have a few more questions here. And as of right now, because I know you had to get on some other ballots, and I believe today was the deadline, correct?
Yeah. There were a couple deadlines. There are a bunch more.
Oh, okay, great.
Can you give me a little time to explain our strategy?
Sure. Actually, that's one of the things that was pretty much – the last, you know, one of the last questions or part of this one, it says, you know, how many state ballots are you on, and is it looking to build the party, or is it, you know, winning the presidency, or the goals, as you said, explain them.
Well, we have long-term goals. We think we're on track to meet our long-term goals. We knew going into this election we didn't have enough people yet, and, you know, in a sense, Robert, that's not our fault. Because we've been saying the same things consistently and offering the same thing for about 5 years now. But the people that we're relying on, the people we think represent the group of people that could save this country, conservatives, they're still, in this election cycle, have been chasing the false flags in the Republican Party. So we didn't have enough people to start with, and we knew it. In fact, last year, we really weren't intending to run. I wasn't intending to run. We weren't intending as a party to run anybody. We were focused on continuing to build up our party. But as it became apparent that they were going to nominate the most liberal governor in the history of the known universe, Mitt Romney, it's like a free pass. Because, I mean, what does it matter? Our people are not going to vote for Romney in any case, no matter how much Romney Republicans bludgeon them. They're not. They don't support people who violated their state's constitution and implemented gay marriage. They don't support people who implemented socialized medicine and $50 copay abortions. They don't support people who banned the exact sort of guns the British went out to Lexington and Concord to try and confiscate. Okay? So it was a free pass. Now, you got to understand, the ballot process across this country, if you ask me a question about it, there's 50 different answers. It's a complex equation, and it's largely rigged as well by the Republican-Democrat monopoly. So we have a strategy to unrig this game, but it can only be done ultimately by a mass of people. Returning to principle, deciding that they're going to take their government back into their own hands. We are doing this without money and without media. intentionally. We are trying to reestablish, you know, self-government of the people, by the people, for the people, in fact. And we will not succeed until the people do it, and we've made sure of that. Now, having said that, that puts us in a practical sense between a rock and a hard place. Since Tampa, since it became apparent to so many more people that the Republican Party is a lost cause into the foreseeable future, more people are coming our way. Now, so I'm on the ballot in California. I'm the nominee. I debated Virgil Goode and the others. Their convention in California, the American Independent Party, nominated me unanimously. And that's the largest electoral prize, 55 electoral votes. We're on the ballot in Florida. We're on the ballot in Colorado.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, which states are you on the ballot for the national election?
I just named them, Robert.
I apologize, Tom, but someone was trying to chat a message to me, so I got distracted. I apologize for that.
No, those are the ones we're directly on the ballot. We are a qualified write-in candidate, and I am, and my running mate is in Texas, Indiana. We're beginning to receive our confirmations back from the counties in Illinois. We're going to run in most places a qualified write-in campaign. This is our attempt, with our still too small numbers, to, you know, get up to the point where the voters representing maybe 75% of the electors will be able to vote for our ticket. The only catch is that people are going to have to write TOMHOEFLING on their ballot.
I see. Well, I mean, that's something we discuss, you know, on a lot of shows, is doing write-ins. You know, a lot of people doing write-ins. And the reason I ask how many people in your state, one reason is that, you know, people who do want to, you know, vote for you on the ballot, they know which state that, you know, they can do that in. And perhaps if you got, I mean, now, would you recommend people, like, would make signs or something like that nature, or their own bumper stickers to promote your candidacy? Or?
Look, at one time, presidential campaigns in this country were run on a front porch basis. William McKinley, in 1896, never left his front porch. But there were other people who went out and campaigned and raised money and did whatever they were going to do to promote William McKinley's candidacy. He gave a series of front porch addresses. The final one was on the steps of the Capitol when they swore him in. Harding, 1920, that was the most recent real front porch campaign. But that was once the way it was done in this country. Now, in this day and age, we have a modern twist. I'm walking around on my front porch, you know, on my phone. I've got a computer setting over here, you know, hooked to the whole world. We've got free websites. You know, the people who founded this country and won our independence from Great Britain, they did it with handwritten letters delivered by horseback. We've got all of these means, free email, free websites, free web video, free web radio. We broadcast out on the web twice a week for 2 hours at a time. You know, we have all of these resources. We don't need the media. We can communicate with one another just fine.
Okay, and the final question, you've probably, and I know you touched on it somewhat before we opened up the questions to the audience, is your long-term goals and strategy to increase the American Party's influence on the political stage?
Well, we're trying to, first and foremost, reestablish principled leadership in this country. We have a leadership vacuum. The Republican Party has become a complete culture of compromise. The weak folks, and you're always going to have some weak folks who are pulled this way and that, the Republican Party in the end pulls them to compromise all of their principles. I always say, look, if you're going to become a Romney Republican, fine, leave your principles by the door. You're not going to need them anymore. Okay, we're trying to create a political culture in our party, a principle, so that the weak people are constantly being pulled toward the principal position. And in a small way so far, we are succeeding. So, you know, we have a leadership pledge. If you go to selfgovernment.us, you can read our platform. We have a leadership pledge there, which is quite explicit. And, you know, signing it is one thing, but it's the beginning for us of a process of accountability to God, accountability to those principles, and accountability to each other. We've been electing a few people to some state legislatures and things. The best legislators are those who have remained accountable. They come and they talk to us. They tell us what's going on. They listen to criticism. We have to reestablish a political culture like that. And so, you know, our party, we've chosen every hard path, not because we like hard, it to be hard, but because we believe these ways are the only way that we're going to actually reestablish the kind of Republican self-government that will secure liberty and deliver a secure, free, prosperous republic to our children and our grandchildren.
Okay, well, great. Well, it's the time to open it up, and I want to thank you for taking my questions. And I want to go back a little bit and apologize for the, you know, about the asking again about the states, as I try to keep an eye on, you know, I listen in and keep an eye on the different chats, and I like to respond to some people in chat, and there's people on Facebook sending me, you know, messages I'm trying to reply for that I'm reading the chat in the, you know, here on the Blog Talk Radio, listening to you. So I apologize for missing that part of the answer.
No, it's no problem. Can I say one more thing on that point before we go to the college?
Sure, go ahead.
People ask me, they say, you know, how do you think you can win with no money and no media? And I tell them it's really, really simple. It's just like this. We're looking for 1 million principled people who still hold these truths to be self-evident. And we're asking them, don't send us your money. Don't do any of that. No, you run your own campaign. You're the campaign manager. You run your own front porch campaign to save America. Go out for these next 2 months, and every day find another person. Go find 50 or 100 or more people between now and election day. Drag them in. Drag them to the polls. And if 1 million people will do that, guess what? We win. You got to remember, Sam Adams said, we don't need a majority to prevail. We just need a minority that is irate and tireless in setting brush fires of freedom in the minds of men. In a practical sense, people forget. Even though you have to have a majority in the Electoral College, within the states, a plurality wins those electoral votes. We only need one more vote than the other two candidates. Conservatives, if they would unite around one conservative, we can always win a plurality everywhere, even in what are considered the most liberal states. Usually we can establish a majority on most things, but we can always do a plurality. It's just a question of, are these folks, these millions of folks, going to continue to support what they say they hate by supporting Mitt Romney? That's the question. That's what will determine whether we can succeed or not. It's up to the people.
Well, I definitely know that the, you know, conservatives who are unwilling to follow Romney and the Republican Party, and also, you know, conservatives who are independent, and there are some Democrat conservatives who I think are looking for a new party, a new home to go to, someone who espouses their core values. And so, they're definitely looking for a new home. That is for certain.
I don't know about you, but I think my family is typical. You know, I've been to a few extended family gatherings in the last year. And, you know, every family has people across the political spectrum. I've got some relatives that are kind of pretty liberal, right? And when I talk to all of them, they all know I'm involved in politics, so they talked about politics to me. And my sense is they all know something is very wrong. And wherever I've gone, I just went to California and showed the flag before the nomination out there. And wherever I go, I tell people, look, these two major parties have failed us. They have us on the edge of bankruptcy, and you can just see the heads going up and down. You don't even have to elaborate. You just assert it, and then you go on and you spell out how we can get our country back. And this is a powerful message, and I believe it's the right message, and I believe if I get the opportunity to be heard, that it's a message that people will respond to.
Okay, great. At this time, then I'll go ahead and I'm just responding to somebody here, as I said, people trying to do some massive multitasking here. I'm going to go ahead and let some of the folks in who have some questions for Tom here, and thank you very much. And the first one I'm going to be bringing these in through the times they have been waiting. And the first one is 919. 919, thank you for calling, and go ahead with your question. Yes, 919, your mic is live. 919. Hello?
I hope I didn't put him to sleep.
No, I don't think so. Okay, well, we'll come back to 919. Possibly there was some difficulties that the person was having there. So the next person I have here is 501. The 919, if you just had a hard time coming in, I'll try you again after 501 has their question asked. So 501, you're live, your mic is live. Go ahead.
Yes, hello?
Hello, yes, 501.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. I can hear you good. Thank you. What's your name and what question you have?
This is Daniel from Arkansas. Hi.
Great.
Mr. Hoffling, first of all, it's a pleasure to be speaking with you. I have been researching you and vetting you, as I like to do with all the other politicians, and which is why I became anti-Romney, anti-Gingrich, anti-Ron Paul from the get-go, basically. And as you can imagine, it turned me into a veritable leper within my own community, as it were. Everybody saw me as some kind of like anomaly, a conservative, actually sticks to conservative principles. Who would think that? But Mr. Hoffling, my question is, you mentioned earlier about abortion, and I did come in sort of halfway through your two-hour mark of a communication. But what are your thoughts on Engel versus Vitale and Earl Warren's benighted decision, which basically with no legal or historical justification came to the conclusion that there was a literal separation between God and country, where the writings of the founders can never be used to establish such a thing. What would you do about Engel versus Vitale?
You know, I'm not a lawyer, and I'll be honest and tell you I'm not familiar with that case, but I can address your question because of your great explanatory paragraph there.
I can give you the minutiae of it if you like.
Well, I probably not, but we probably don't have enough time for that. But I can tell you that, you know, the First Amendment is quite explicit, okay? The Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or, what's the final phrase? I'm drawing a blank here. But the bottom line is Congress can't make any law concerning this matter. Okay, so the federal government has absolutely no business telling the American people anything about this.
Absolutely.
Okay? But to separate religion from men is, first of all, impossible, because what you believe about God is what makes you what you are. So if you try and drive God out of government in that way, it's doomed to fail in the first place, because all you're going to do, nature abhors a vacuum. In other words, if you go out and, you know, stupid courts say you can't pray in Jesus' name, okay, you know, all you're doing is creating a vacuum for something else to enter that space. And it ain't going to be something very, very pretty or very helpful or very constructive. It's going to be something dark. And that's why our schools are in the mess they're in, or it's one of the reasons our schools are in the mess they're in.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I want government out of the schools, period. I want their noses out of the education of our children. I as a parent, the education of my children is my responsibility, not the state's. And I don't want my children anywhere where they're going to teach them things that violate my most precious principles and beliefs. So it's a one-way street. Government has no business dictating this, and they have no business in telling us what we can and can't do in this area. It's very simple.
Absolutely. And the the rest of the First Amendment that you were looking for was or prohibit the free exercise thereof.
Yeah, thank you. It's been
which
a long day.
That, no, it's okay. You know about it more intrinsically than Obama would if he was taught it for the same 24 hours a day, basically. He would not
know
what that.
Earlier today, somebody was asking me about my education, and they were looking at my website, and they said, you attended Ralston, Nebraska schools, you know, but that's it. Yeah, I'm a ninth grade dropout. Okay, I went back a couple years later and got a diploma with a GED, right? Okay, and I said, so, you know, if college degrees are your criteria for who you're going to vote for president, definitely go vote for Romney. I think he has some degrees. Go vote for Obama. He allegedly does. Okay? Don't vote for me. But consider this. You know, I'm self-educated, and guess what? I can read the Constitution with understanding, and they apparently cannot.
Absolutely. Well, they believe the Constitution is something to be metamorphosed through a judicial, legislative, and executive fiat. Basically, the will of the statist over the will of the layman, the American everyday man, the countryman.
Well,
that,
yes, and in the first place, the will of God.
Absolutely. And that the DNC convention, it perfectly epitomizes what they represent: the godless, hedonistic, secularist sort of anti-Christian platform that the Democratic Party has metamorphosed into. It's just it's
but
amazing.
equally bad are those who pay lip service to God and then act like he doesn't exist in the other major party.
Well, with Mitt Romney,
hold on, folks. I apologize, but I'm looking in the chat here, and I'm going to scroll up. Is Deanna, I hope I pronounce it right, asked if they can ask some questions without calling in. And sure, go ahead. I can't promise I'll be able to get to all the questions that are in the chat because we do have multiple people on the line waiting to be heard. So at this point, what I'm going to do is I will let the the next person in to excuse me. To ask their question, and then if people want to put a question in the chat, go ahead, and then I'll look through the chat and see which one to ask. Mr. Hoefling, is that satisfactory to everyone? Is that good for you, Tom?
Hey, I'm good for whatever you think is best.
Okay,
thank
great.
You,
well, I appreciate that. Well, thank you for calling in, sir. Thank you for offering your questions tonight. We appreciate it, and, you know, for the people who are new here, you've just come in, as you just pointed out. If you like what you hear tonight and like some of the other shows, you're more than welcome to follow Bard's Logic, and that's easy. Just go to the page where you see the icon of the homepage of Bard's Logic Political Talk and just click the little follow button afterwards. And thank you very much. And also you'll see in the description area of tonight's episode, tonight's show, you'll see two links there, one for Tom Hoefling, www.tomhoefling.com, and you'll also see www.selfgovernment.us, which I believe is the America's Party's website. But thank you once again, and at this point, I'm going to let in 352, and then after 352, I will take a question from the chat, and then after that question, I will be letting in 360. So 352, I'm getting ready to let you on. 352, what you got for us tonight? Yeah, 352. Hello, 352, you're on air. Okay, well, we could go back to 352, perhaps 919, who we were trying to get to earlier, but couldn't chime in. So let's see if 919 is back ready to take your question. 919. It sounds like 919 is typing. Okay, well, I'll put 919 back on hold, and so what I'll do is I will go to the chat, and let me scroll up. Let's see if I see any questions here. Someone mentioned, so I'm thinking perhaps she might have put. So, Dan, if you have a question, go ahead and put it in chat, or anyone else, of course, for that nature. Let's see. I'd like to hear about your convention. It says, thank you. I wanted to hear about his convention. And in parentheses, it says spiritual. I don't know what that means. But.
Oh, wait, our convention?
Mm-hmm. I guess where you were nominated?
I see. Well, we held our America's Party convention in February, and that's when I was nominated. I was also nominated by the American Independent Party in California, a party that's been around for more than 40 years, and they have the presidential ballot line in California. I was nominated at their convention unanimously, and so that's how we got on the ballot in California. And we're going to be putting a lot of our efforts.
I apologize for interrupting you, Tom. She said, no, your conversion, I guess spiritual conversion. I'm not familiar with that. That's of a personal nature. So that's clearly up to you whether you want to answer that or not.
Well, no, I have no problem with answering it. I became a Christian as a child. Didn't have a lot of tending of that faith when I was a kid from those around me. And really, it was in my 20s that God really got a hold of me, and I really put my nose in my Bible for a good decade. And so, the founders of this country, if you go back and you analyze all of the references they make and the framing of our founding instruments, the number one thing they make reference to is the Bible, by far. There's nothing else even close. The second one is William Blackstone, who was the proponent of the natural law basis for this country. And so, I became a Christian then. I haven't walked perfectly before God by any means. I've had my ups and downs, but he's always picked me up and dusted me off. And, his mercies are new every morning. So, I definitely have a Christian basis for my political philosophy entirely. And I'm not shy about telling anyone who asks that.
Okay, well, at this point, is it okay if I let in another caller, Tom?
That's sure.
Okay, 360, you're next. I'm about to open up your mic. Yes, 360,
unmuted.
You are live. You are unmuted.
Gentlemen, I am alive.
Yes, you are. Good night, and thank you for calling in.
Well, I know Robert. We know each other. I'm the one that kept diverting him in chat. And Tom, you and I talked a few days ago before you went on to your radio program, and then I followed you over there, and then I had to leave and get back to Robert's show. So you remember that conversation?
Yeah.
Okay. Just to connect. One of the things, and I think this is really an amazing conversation. It really is, because it touches the hearts of all Christians and believers across the country, and it's a big issue. And we've watched our country be stripped of those Judeo-Christian values. We've watched it, the federal government take control of everything. And one of the things that Robert asked you, because we're doing a series on states' rights right now with Kelly Mordecai, who is the author of The Fourth Branch of Government, or The Fourth Branch is what he calls his book, sharp guy, and we're doing this whole series because, most of us who have any age on us remember a world when we didn't really know who the federal government was, and now we have a world where the federal government dictates just about everything right down to, just everything and, around us. And so people in today's world don't understand how much of an invasion the federal government has moved into states over the last 30, 40, 50 years. And Robert asked you that question about states' rights, and you talked about the states' rights around the abortion issue, which I totally understand, and I get that. And I get that issue of this shouldn't even be a discussion because it's a life. Well, here's the challenge. They had the discussion. They had the court case, and they're killing, tens of millions of babies a year. So, and it seems like since Roe v. Wade, nobody's been able to pull it out of the toilet. And so on one hand, I understand, and you and I chatted about this a little bit, but it still seems like a pretty monumental task to change that. And let's say you do change it. Let's say you are elected, and you're in there for 4 years, and then the Democrats beat the crap out of us and come back and take it over, and then they take over the presidency, and then they change it all back. I mean, what have we done? In other words, I understand the fight, and I understand what's trying to be accomplished, but it seems like Democrats are really good at taking away things from the Constitution and stepping up. Well, so are Republicans, don't get me wrong. I beat up Republicans pretty bad. Yeah, I'm probably much worse than you are. You're very polite to me, compared to how hard I beat up Republicans and what they've done the last,
Before you get too far down the road, let me answer a few of those things, or else I'm not going to remember all of them.
That's all right. I won't forget them.
Okay. In the first place, I didn't just mention abortion. I mentioned entitlements and all of those things. Now, if the state constitution allows it, there are certain aspects of those federal programs that I suppose could be done with the state. Now, you could have an argument about, our constitution guarantees that each of the states has a Republican form of government. We could have a long, deep discussion about whether, Romney Care would be, within the realm of a Republican government. But we know that those things should be taken right away out of the hands of the feds because they're not constitutional. They're a violation of the oath of office of every single member of Congress, every judge, and every president. So I didn't just touch on life. Look, what we have is what we call a federal government. The founders tended to call it the general government or the national government.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Correct.
We have one that is not doing what they ought. In other words, protecting life, liberty, and property, protecting our national sovereignty, protecting our borders, protecting our people. That's their job primarily.
Right.
They're not doing that. While at the same time, they're doing all of these things that they ought not. So we need people. We've got to clean house. We've got to throw all the bums out in Washington and in all 50 state capitals. They're also awash, in corruption. So, we need to throw those people out. We need to get people who will quit doing what they ought not forthwith and start doing what they ought.
And I totally get that from a philosophical sense. I'm looking at it from a practical sense of a $300 million, $16 trillion budget with 40 cents on the dollar being borrowed from China with wars and impending wars and building nations around the world. How do we do that? How do we make that shift, I guess, is I'm kind of a project manager, so I kind of get down to black and white.
Let me be quite explicit. You mentioned, the Democrats and the left will come back. Obama and his ilk couldn't even have any political power at all if it wasn't for the compromisers running around who call themselves conservatives.
Oh, I agree.
There have been multiple huge surveys. I'm not a big fan of polling. It's primarily manipulation.
Yeah.
But there are actual scientific surveys, some on a huge scale, that over and over again have shown that there are more self-identified conservatives in every single state in this union by far than there are self-identified liberals, okay?
Correct.
That being the case, why aren't conservatives and conservative principles being proportionally represented? We're supposed to be a representative form of government, right? But we're not being represented. Those who are supposed to be carrying the conservative standard are fakes, namely the Republicans.
Yeah.
So the first step to fixing what you're talking about is we got to take down these phonies. We got to clean up our own house. Look, we have to reestablish the plumb line of American principles, starting with the natural law principles of the Declaration of Independence, the stated purposes of the Constitution. We got to hold up that plumb line. And we got to bring the focus on that and make that the political battle line once again. And if you're over there, I'm sorry, I may like you personally, but you're standing where the artillery is going to be landing. Please come back over here, okay? I'll beg you, come over here because that our artillery is headed your way. We're not
right.
going to quit firing until we get our country back. So it's all about principle. If anyone thinks they can get this country back and put it back on the right track economically in terms of our foreign policy, our strength in the world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, they're fooling themselves.
Do you believe that the RNC, you know, we've had this conversation, this third-party conversation.
Chris, real quick. I've got about 3 minutes for you, Chris, and then I'm going to ask a question from the chat. And then after the question from the chat is answered, then I'm going to go to 501. So it's going to go, Chris, finish up in the next couple minutes.
No,
and then...
Put me on the back end of that, Robert. I'm fine.
Oh, okay. Well, now I can't even talk. Mute the mic, because I hate to say mute the mic because people get all riled up. It's not that I'm trying to silence anybody. It's just I'm trying to, you know, break things up and give someone just the mic themselves. So that's why I'm doing that. I'm muting the mic. So and I'll just stay on the line, though, Chris, and we'll let you back in if we get through these other calls. And I also want to give the opportunity for 919 and 352 who called in another opportunity to ask their question if they're able to get back on. So thank you very much, Chris. I appreciate your questions. And so I'm going to go to the question in the chat. And the question was from Ken, and he asks about Article 1, Section 8, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11 of the U.S. Constitution. It says, would impact his decision related on, or how would, okay, let me read this. Just how would Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11 of the U.S. Constitution impact, I guess, your, Tom, decisions related to foreign policy if elected?
I'm not a chapter and verse kind of guy. So you'll have to forgive me while I don't want to answer the question unless I know exactly what I'm answering. So give me a moment to pull it up here on my screen, just a second.
Oh, sure, yeah, take your time.
Okay, what are we, Article 1, Section 2, or no, Section 8?
Section 8.
Okay, hold on.
The War Power Clause.
Okay, hold on. Well, I'm not finding it here real quick. Do you have it up in front of you?
No, I do not. No,
okay.
I don't either.
So, again, I'm the kind of person that I absorb the principles, and then I gotta use my search engine to go find it when I need it. Okay, so
sure.
But in terms of war powers, the President of the United States is given great power by our Constitution, from the people via our Constitution, the Commander-in-Chief. However, it's the Congress that has the longer list of war powers, actually. And our problem is we have a bunch of people in elected office today who are primarily buck passers. You know, that's why we have a Fed, okay, because they gave this quasi-governmental agency the job to do that they were supposed to be doing, for example. And the same is true when it comes to war making. Congress is always pushing off the responsibility, except when they don't want to. Then they're trying to usurp the authority of the president. There's always this tension between the executive branch, the commander-in-chief, and the Congress. In this administration, of course, one of the worst examples we saw of how out of kilter everything is when it comes to war making was Obama's little excursion into Libya. He never even sought any counsel from the Congress whatsoever until way after the fact. And guess what? Congress didn't make a peep. Okay, so, I don't know if I'm answering your question sufficiently, but we need to look at those exact powers that he's talking about. We need to begin to act according to them. And the president, look, he has the obligation to act if we're threatened, even before. I mean, for example, Pearl Harbor, he didn't need to, our military, those people in Pearl Harbor that were under his command didn't have to wait for an act of Congress to fire their machine guns, okay? You see?
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, Franklin Roosevelt stood up in front of Congress and he said, you know, a state of war exists. So he admitted the obvious fact that we're at war, okay? So he stood up in front of Congress and said, it's time for you to exercise your constitutional duty and declare war. You see? So, I mean, I think I have a pretty good natural grasp of how
well,
this balance is supposed to work.
Well, to elaborate on the question, then we'll get to 501, person on hold 501. I guess he wants to know whether you believe or not that the executive branch does or does not possess the authority to go to war.
Well,
does
for
the executive branch possess the authority to go to war? I believe what he's asking.
Well, yes, but not to stay at war, because the president, as the commander in chief, is. Primary obligation is to protect the lives, the liberty, the property of the people, our sovereignty, our territory. So if we're attacked, if we're threatened, he has the obligation to act while consulting with Congress and seeking, their imprimatur on what he's doing. And if he doesn't get it eventually, you know, that's going to have to stop. Now, he swore an oath to support the Constitution, which contains these obligations he has. If Congress fails, you know, there's certain points where he has an obligation to check and balance the Congress. So he has hard decisions to make. Ultimately, if the Congress doesn't like it, they can impeach him. So there's always going to be this tension. It's intrinsic to our Constitution. It's intrinsic to our form of government. But, you know, it's way out of whack right now.
Okay, well, at this point, I'm going to go to 501, and then after 501, 219, you will be next. So 501, tell us your name and what's on your mind. And location, too. I'm kind of curious where the people are from, too, if you don't mind. No cities involved. I mean, just what state?
Hello?
Yes, 501.
Hi.
Name of state, and then what's on your mind?
This is Daniel in Arkansas again. Hi, Mike and Tom. How are you?
Oh, great. Okay, go ahead.
Tom, I wanted to touch on the issue of abortion. It's unlike some of the other issues, it's a very personal issue for me because I firmly believe an ex of mine aborted a child behind my back. So it's unlike some of the other, you know, like the dollar and cents issues, it's very personal for me. So I've noticed in debates with liberals that they've started using the whole the argument that if we're going to use the Constitution to say that it protects the unborn, then that would mean that the Constitution then therefore makes all children, whether illegal or not illegal, automatic citizens. So I was just wondering, how would you respond to something like that? I know it's
farcical,
but...
Yeah, I know. Liberals are silly. No, the 14th Amendment is quite explicit, and it mentions two different classes of people. It mentions citizens with certain privileges and immunities, and it mentions persons. Okay, and it guarantees the protection of the life, the liberty, and the property of all persons in all jurisdictions in this country. Now, every citizen is a person, but not every person is a citizen. In other words, you can have tourists here. You could have people working here on a visa. You could have even an illegal alien that is here. Okay, does that mean somebody, if there's an illegal alien in your town, does that mean you can go kill him constitutionally? No. Does it mean you can place him into servitude? No. Does it mean that you can steal from him and not be punished by the law? No. But does he have the privileges and immunities of a citizen? He's not supposed to, no. But, I mean, look, you know, we should treat those in the womb exactly the same way we treat everybody else. In fact, we always have in terms of inheritance rights and things like that, even in our courts. That continues. A child in the womb, you can't just strip them of their rights under a will, for example. But because of the incredible insanity of abortion, a mother could, for example, she could, in a will, her child could be endowed with a certain amount of money, but she would get it if the child wasn't there. She could, under our lawless regime now, she could kill the baby and inherit the money, you see?
Yes.
So abortion throws everything out of whack. It just violates our most fundamental principles, and it just, it's, you know, if you look at countries over the course of history, if you read some history, you can discern a pattern. The first pattern is, like, Russia, for example, or Germany or whatever. They abandon God. They begin to ignore God. Then they begin to lose their regard for the prerogatives, for the lives of those who are made in God's image and likeness. So they lose their respect for innocent human life. And right in this, the train of all of that, of course, liberty just melts away. It's inevitable. Your liberties just begin to go. And we're well down that process of ignoring God, losing our respect for innocent life, and then people act surprised that our liberties are going away. They shouldn't be surprised.
And with that, Tom, I'd like to thank the gentleman again for calling in.
Great question.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I'd like at this time to bring in 219 with the questions that they have. So 219, name, state, and state's more for my curiosity, and your question. And thank you for calling in.
Is that me?
If you're 219.
Okay.
Hello.
All right. Well, you know, it's just an area code. There could be like 5,000 people calling from this area code. So, you know, time's catching on.
There you go. What state are you from?
Indiana. But I'm a native Georgian, you know, brought up here because my wife was from here and wanted to go back home to die. So here we are.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
I want to do two things. First, I want to comment on the caller that was just talking about abortion and the displacements that it causes in the society. I'm gonna kind of uncloak here. My name, I use Piano Butch on Facebook, and a lot of people know me because I've written a lot about liberty. But I'm an Orthodox priest, and my church name is Archpriest Simeon Elias. And I'm a product of rape. I have 6 children, and, you know, I'm not even going to take a stab at the number of grandchildren and great-grandchildren because I always get the number wrong, and when I do, I catch hell.
You won't catch hell for me, sir.
Well,
my dad's mom had 18 children.
No, but what I'm saying, when I get the number wrong, you know, they tell me, no, that's not the run you've forgotten. So and it changes every year. How can you keep up with it at this age? But here's the point. Do I deserve the wonderful life I have lived? Do I deserve it? Who on the face of this earth, besides God and me, has the prerogative to stand between me and my living, and my joy in living, and my Creator, and my love for my Savior Jesus Christ? Tell me who that is. Is it the woman who was raped? Now, she was a marvelous, marvelous, marvelous woman in strength and faith. And even though she never liked me, she gave me everything I needed. And when she was like in her 70s, she called me to her bedside when she thought she was dying. And she said to me with all kinds of guilt, "You know, I haven't loved you like I ought to." And what a lie that was, because she gave me life. You hear that? She gave me life. And here it was. I said to her, "You don't have to apologize to me for anything." I knew she didn't like me. I knew she didn't want me around. I knew that every time she saw me, that I reminded her of her rapist. but what a hero she was to give me life, and what a hero my children think of their grandmother, and my great-grandchildren think of their great-grandmother. Think about it. Now, had it been Roe v. Wade and a few years later, and she had had the convenience of going and wiping me away, well, guess what? Go on YouTube and look up my stage name, Bond Robin. And listen to the music that I recorded and find out if I'm some kind of inferior human being.
Why,
guess what?
I'm just going to interject with something that I seen one time. It was on point. It's on point. It's a little cartoon. This is years ago when I was just, I was pretty young. And I guess I was either a teenager or early, 20, something of that nature. But I seen a cartoon where this person's in a church or what have you praying and says, it was an abortion doctor actually, was praying. I know, but it's just a cartoon. But says, God, how come you don't send somebody to, heal our sick, and how do you want somebody to end hunger and cure diseases and, cure these ills and stop the wars? And God looks down and answers, and I'm shaking his head, said, I did, but you aborted them. It's a little, it's not funny, but that's the point,
That's the old joke about, one child born dead and the next one who was born blind, and the next one, should you abort it? Well, you just killed Beethoven. You remember that line.
Hey, allow me to respond here, gentlemen. Piano, it's an honor to meet you via voice, and your story is very moving, and it's I appreciate your willingness to come out and lay yourself out here this way. I'll do the same. Okay, I'll respond in kind. My mother, after my older sister was born, got severe postpartum depression. This was in the late 50s, and it turned into schizophrenia. And in fact, I was carried while she was hospitalized. And when I was born, I went directly to live with aunts and uncles. 5 years later, she was still institutionalized, and she conceived a child. You could call it rape. I think it was probably rape. Now, If my life would have been conceived after Roe, I have little doubt that I would have been aborted. My sister, definitely, if it had been post-Roe, she would have been aborted. She was adopted. I didn't even know of her existence until I was in my 30s, actually. But she grew up in a Christian home out in Nebraska. She married. She has three beautiful children. She has a beautiful grandson. Her daughter served in the United States Air Force. So what was her life worth? What is her life worth? Look, it's a violation of just basic human decency to destroy a small child for the sin or the crime of another person. It's barbarity. And I got to say one other thing about all of this.
Real quick, I want to let somebody else in. I'm not trying to be rude. It's just we've got other people on hold who'd like to come in, and we're running out of time here. I'm sorry.
But hang on. Before you put me off, I got one question I got to ask Tom to make it worthwhile.
Go ahead.
Tom, you listening? Okay. Centuries back to 1844, technology developed. If you took and made it like a graph, it was three blocks long. Human development was about a quarter of an inch high. And in the year 1844, the line turned almost 90 degrees upwards, and technology exploded. Now, here's my question. We know that the Constitution was written before technology exploded. We know that the Constitution is based upon Paine's doctrine of everybody's placement in society via the need for their labor, that was the social contract, that a man was worth his labor. Now, here we are to a point with technology that a relatively few number of the population can create all the goods and services that are needed for the rest. How do the rest find their place in society? We look at Costco, we look at Walmart, we look at all the other stores that have wiped out Main Street all over the country because they're able to use technology to provide all those goods and services. And here we are in this, I'm an old guy, but my dad was the fellow who assumed that he was my dad and accepted me as his child. Was born in 1900. He was 7 years old before he saw his first horseless carriage. So knowing that those documents and those principles were before technology and that man is facing the most challenging period in his life because of technology, how do we create the social contract now?
Okay. Well, let me answer.
Very quickly, because I've got a lot more people if you want to come on.
I understand. That's a deep question. But, look, Mitt Romney talks about human capital, okay? He thinks we're all a bunch of workers and consumers, okay? The answer to your question is human worth is what it is. This is what's so beautiful about America. Our country was founded on everlasting principles and self-evident truth that can survive the rise of technology. And we can adjust as human beings. But the things that are most important are not materialist, okay? So we just have to get back to those core moral values, and we can handle whatever comes along in that sense. We can handle the economy, too. We can produce. We can become a productive society once again rather than a consumptive society. We can have a thrift society rather than a consumption, debt-based society. We can do that if we decide to do it. So that's my short answer.
Okay, now, Tom, you know that you and I hold a huge amount, as you express, in common. I mean, let's face it, if we were conceived in 2010, we wouldn't exist. You and I would not exist. You have answered for me in general terms that we can. But I want you to go back to the drawing board, and next time I talk to you, I want you to tell me how we can. Okay, because I don't know.
I can't tell you that I have all the answers. I would be glad to have a conversation outside this limited time space we have here.
Yeah, and I apologize for that, guys. Hate to limit the amount of time that people can have, but I'm trying to be, get as many
God
people in as
guys.
Possible. Take care, and thank you very
guys.
Much for calling in. I apologize for that, but
No need to apologize.
Oh, but thank you very much. Well, the next person I'm going to have in here is I'm going to try 352 again. Because 352, we couldn't reach last time, so I'm going to go ahead and try to get you in again. So 352, your mic is live. You there? 352.
I have a 352.
You have 352?
Yes, I do, but I did not realize I buzzed in. But that's all right.
Do you have a question to ask, or?
Well, I can comment real quickly. You guys just brought tears to my eyes. And I would like to ask, what books does Mr. Hoeplin read?
Well, I just saw Sarah Palin now for a second. But
I mean, do y'all have books in Alaska? I would.
Go ahead, guys. I'm just digressing. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's all right. I mean, that's better than boxers or briefs by far. I mean, books are at least important. I mean, I've always been a reader since I was a little kid. I've devoured everything in sight, newspapers, every book I could find. The rise of the internet kind of changes the equation. I mean, my Bible, of course, has been, by far my most read book. I've worn out more of them than I can tell you. And if I'm not wearing out a Bible, I probably am not reading it as much as I should. But you know, I mean, I'm a big Tolkien fan. I always have been since I was a little kid. As far as I'm concerned, the best fiction ever written. I always was a Tom Clancy fan. I always liked his books, things like that. But mainly, you know, I don't really get much time these days to read too many books. I'm editing 30-some websites on a daily basis. I'm working with people all over the country, educating people about our founding principles constantly, writing, reading, editing. You know, so I mean, I spend my life reading, but not necessarily books these days.
That's good. Thank you.
Okay, well, great. Well, thank you very much for calling in. I really appreciate it. The next person I've got here in line is 832. I'm getting ready to open up your mic, 832. Just give us a name and location and give us your questions. 832, your mic is live. Thank you very much for calling in tonight.
Hey, guys. Good evening. This is Gene Crane down in Savannah. And, Tom, you've been on the campaign trail for several months now. And I say the campaign trail. I misspoke there. You've been campaigning for the past few months. Tell us some of the obstacles and some of the things you've learned during this segment of your life that you didn't expect to run into, some of the challenges, just how this whole experience has been for you.
Well, that's a great question, Gene. Thank you. Well, for one thing, I've been on the campaign trail for about 2 decades now, but primarily I was the behind-the-scenes guy, writing speeches, setting up websites, you know, organizing on the ground, et cetera, et cetera. You know, our campaign now is completely different than any other campaign in that I'm not on the campaign trail. I have had to make a couple forays because I had no choice. There were just practical things that I had to go do a couple of times. But primarily, I'm running a front porch campaign from right here at home. I'm taking care of my family every day. We have 4 small children at home. In terms of your question about what have I learned, well, I don't know. It's been part of a learning curve over 20 years. You know, in a way, I'm not surprised by anything in this campaign. I mean, maybe that sounds arrogant. I don't know. But I've kind of predicted the progression of things. If you talk to our regulars or the people who've listened into our twice weekly national conference calls over the last 4 and 5 years, you know, I've kind of like said, this is what's going to happen, and it's happened. We've been predicting the demise of the GOP. There are some things that just seem so obvious to me. I look at them and say, you know, if you do A, B must ensue. And so,
right.
Probably the most surprising thing to me, I guess, even when you predict it, when the reality comes forth, it can still be kind of shocking. I mean, I've been predicting the heavy-handed tactics of the Romney Republicans. They're Alinskyite tactics and all of those things. But to actually see them actually put their boot on and crush the grassroots people into the ground is still a shocking thing to watch. But that's all just an observation. Excuse me?
I was just saying it's certainly not the America that we grew up to expect anyway.
No, it's not. It's not American at all. It's actually Soviet. I've been calling the whole process Soviet now for 5 years. I mean, do you remember, the Supreme Soviet was still meeting most of my life, right? The first half of my life. And, you know, you remember those meetings where they all, you know, had a vote, and they all voted aye at the same time, and they all looked like little drones, you know.
Right.
And that's where we're headed with this. And, you know, the only difference at this point is the dissenters, they are not putting a bullet in their head yet.
I got you. Well, one more quick question before he cuts me off. If your campaign is on target and you're pretty much following in the lines that you predicted and expected to be, what is your objective in this political season? I mean, naturally, you would like to be elected in be president, but how do you stand on ballot access and percentages as far as recognition? Are you just spreading the word of the party?
Well, we are trying to build the party, and that is an overriding thing. We want to have principled leadership in every community in this country. We want every state party to be organized. We want regular meetings being held, you know, discussing the principles, bringing people back to principles, but also discussing on a constant basis how can we get our country back on a practical basis. So that's certainly, you know, we're going to be about that task, win or lose, because we think that's more important in the larger sense than the outcome of any particular election. So, you know, in terms of ballot access, we're way behind the curve. I play with all my cards up on the face up on the table. Have you noticed?
Right.
You know, we didn't have enough people at the beginning of this process. They were all chasing the Republican false flag. But they're starting to come in now. And in fact, you know, look, if we have a sufficient mass of people, we can overcome any obstacle that the Republican-Democrat monopoly has. We can overcome any of it. If the American people ever wake up once again to their power, there's nothing on this earth that can stop them.
Sure.
And I think it's a great statement to, unfortunately, end this segment tonight, and I really appreciate all the people who've called in. And for those people who are on hold, Wayne's getting in, I really apologize to people who had questions in the chat. I apologize if I wasn't able to get to those as well. Maybe perhaps some other time we can have Tom on again, you know, for other segments, for other questions. But once again, I'd like to thank everyone who came and called in tonight with some questions, and also thank people in the chat and listening on other venues. And for those who are going to be listening to this show in the archive, on the recorded version, I want to thank you, Tom, very much for coming in. It was great having you here. And just two things to finish things off. One is if you came in later and you haven't heard me, say if you like the show and you'd like to hear more what Bard's Logic has out there for what we're going to be covering, like states' rights and, you know, candidates, go ahead and just follow the show. You just go to the homepage of Blog Talk Radio. I mean, this the Blog Talk Radio page for Bard's Logic Political Talk. And on the icon, you'll find the little follow button. Just click that, and then you'll be following the show. And also, two links you'll find on the homepage. For Tom is his website, www.tomhoefling.com, and then also the website, selfgovernment.us. That's www.selfgovernment.us, and you can find those links in the description section of the show. So I'd like to close this out, as I do every night on Bard's Logic Political Talk, is by playing the ending song by Aubrey Ashburn, and you can hear more of her music on www.aubreyashburn.com. And here you go. Thank you, everyone, again for coming in. Take care and have a good night, and we'll talk later. Good night.